touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to the Scott Holman Podcast, back here in our starting-to-be-usual spot on a Monday night, talking all things Houston Cougars. We have a nice blend tonight of a couple of off-season additions to Cougar men's basketball, which is obviously something we're very interested in. We know the fan base at large has been paying very close attention to the portal and who's coming in, and we got in a really short amount of time for the weeks of waiting here now that we've been in the off-season. A mini flurry of activity at the Cougar men's basketball, as well as track and field, like an overdue on our part dive into the outdoor season they've had so far, an encouraging outdoor season with a number of athletes at the or near the top of their respective events. We're talking about that. Bat and ball sports, mostly good vibes over there. Haven't always been able to say that this year, Dustin. The first time I have typed up baseball notes this year and felt like I was being fairly universally positive and not unfairly so. So we're going off season, we're going in season, we're getting a nice mix tonight while trying to keep everything a little bit tighter than maybe we were in the last couple of months to still feel like we're covering the whole thing while not taking 90 to 100 minutes to do so. Always the goal. Dustin, my good friend, my co-host, how are you doing in this Monday evening?
Man, I'm doing pretty good. I've feel like everything's kind of trending in the right direction, like you said. Bat and ball sports combined 9-3 in conference play thus far. Track and field looking pretty strong in the outdoor season, and you know, after last episode we were talking about Tremont Mark going out. This time we're talking about a transfer coup times two heading in the other direction. So feeling all in all pretty good about everything we have to talk about tonight.
And Dustin, you know what I'm feeling pretty good about?
What are you feeling pretty good about, Sam?
The fact that I in our latest premium episode, our portal wish list here, I may have inadvertently predicted two of the four guys I talked about becoming Houston Cougars in the foreseeable future. Definitely didn't predict one of them, but if you would like to listen to that and all the other premium content we have put out there at patreon.com/shpawdcast, you're going to do that for only 16 cents a day, $5 a month, which I assume is roughly the price of a cup of coffee at Starbucks. I'd like to think I'm at least on par with Starbucks and 75% of the other national coffee chains. And of course, we are proud members of the 1012 Network. Please follow them on Twitter at TEN12 Network. Subscribe to the 1012 Podcast, talking all things a Big 12 Conference Athletics, wherever you put podcasts in your ears. And of course, what Dustin probably thought I was about to do a oh-so-smooth segue to, going to talk about real quick our good friends at the good brand Homefield Apparel, homefieldapparel.com. After just an incredible March Madness, they've got a number of I guess school refreshes, a couple of new schools coming here in the next couple weeks, and you can save 15%, listener. If you are someone who has not partaken in Homefield, or you're a newer listener and you're just finding out about this, I like to assume that every podcast is someone's first, you can avail yourself of a great, incredibly comfortable, vintage, premium Houston Cougar collection and hundreds of other schools just by using the promo code HOLMAN12. That's Holman12 at checkout. You're going to save 15% off that first order, and you're going to look darn good doing it, whether you're looking to buy the Cougs or you're looking at a number of great collections, big-name schools outside of big-name schools. You name them, Homefield's got them, and you're going to look good wearing it. So that's Homefield Apparel. homefieldapparel.com, promo code Holman12. You know the drill, listeners. We're going to start, of course, even though it might feel a little weird in theory to lead with a sport that's in the offseason. We have a few in-season ones we're going to talk about tonight, but I don't think we're going to get too much argument from the listenership that this topic doesn't merit being the lead story. That is Cougar men's basketball having themselves quite the active Easter weekend, adding not one but two transfers to the roster. The first one, certainly a familiar name. We got a somewhat pleasant surprise this weekend. I'm going to lead with a surprise, as on Saturday, Temple guard Damian Dunn committed to the Cougars late morning, I believe, and just over 24 hours later, on Sunday morning, after taking the official visit earlier in the weekend, recently former Baylor guard LJ Cryer announced on Instagram that he himself was committing to the Cougars. So two big additions right there. Dustin, what are your initial thoughts on Mr. Dunn and Mr. Cryer?
Yeah, it's excited to get them both in. Two guards, two players who each averaged 15 points a game this last season. Two guys who have dealt with injuries in the past. Two guys who had insane laundry lists of offers as transfers this offseason. It'll come one kind of differentiating factor. You know, you had one player in Dunn who, you know, I know you kind of had were somewhat wildly speculating that he might come here. I don't think I'd seen anything from anybody tying him to Houston whatsoever until like the moment that he committed. Whereas Cryer, it kind of seemed like it was kind of a pretty open secret that he was gonna come home to Houston. But you know, I think the primary obvious, you know, from 10,000 feet overview summary is that the Cougars have replaced Marcus Sasser and Tremont Mark respectively with Cryer and Dunn, with Cryer being a heavy three-point shooting, you know, is he a point guard or a two guard type of player, as was Marcus Sasser, and you know, Dunn having a little bit more size, having a little bit more balance to his offensive game, like Tremont Mark. And certainly we'll get more into the weeds here and talk about these guys individually, because they are their own players, and obviously the coaching staff is not going to ask LJ Cryer to be Marcus Sasser. They're going to ask him to be LJ Cryer, and you know, ditto for Dunn. But you know, the larger point I think stands that, you know, you had lost two of your starting guards and you just brought in two very highly sought after guards, two guys who can absolutely be quality starters in, you know, the toughest basketball conference in the country, which is what Houston is entering next year.
As I said earlier, and I promise I will be mentioning for the very last time here, you allude to it, about 12 hours before Dunn committed, I actually talked about him as part of a four-man Portal Wishlist Premium podcast. And like you said, it was kind of an open secret. We were told on pretty good authority that Cryer was a top target of the staff and that they were very bullish on the prospects of him joining the program. But to be clear, I had no inside info on Damian Dunn. We had not seen or heard anything specifically about Dunn other than that very generally U of H was pursuing another transfer guard in addition to Cryer, but had no specific info or even hint that it was Dunn. Clearly, all parties involved in this did a good job keeping the mutual interest under wraps, which isn't the easiest thing to do in this day and age. I think what I like most about Dunn is that we're talking about a guy who's played a lot of college basketball and I think has the specific skills that would be really useful for next year's version of Cougar basketball. He was specifically this past season in the individual top 100, both fouls drawn per 40 minutes and free throw rate, made just over 81%. From the free throw line, was inside the top 150 in both of those categories. The prior season made just over 83% of his freebies that year, and was actually, even though this is a season with a lot of weird data sets, including this Temple team that Dunn was on, who played a really small number of games even for that season, he was actually the number one guy in the country during the COVID season 2020-2021 at fouls drawn per 40 minutes. And I like this, and I'm highlighting this at the top because I think getting to the line a lot, being someone who's good at making those free throws when you do get there, it's a really valuable skill, and a skill that, for all the program's recent success, I don't think we've seen the Cougars have someone with that skill super consistently recently. I mean, I think you could make an argument for Jairus Walker, but he also wasn't the best when he got there. And Damian Dunn hasn't been a super efficient scorer, though I think he's shown at least the ability to score on all three levels. But I don't think his numbers from this past season, which were 45% overall from the field and just over 35 on three-pointers, I don't know if it's worth extrapolating a lot off that, because I also think Dunn's not going to be asked to do as much offensively as maybe he was asked to do this past year at Temple. And he's going to come to this program with, even with the departures of Sasser and Mark, a number of really talented scorers projected to be there. He took well over 300 shots each of the past two seasons. I feel confident predicting that that's not going to be the kind of volume we see from him in the coming season. If needed, though, he can be your go-to guy if he's feeling it, and he could be a secondary ball handler as well. Give you some length in the backcourt with the high likelihood that your other two guys starting there, Jamal Shedd and LJ Cryer, a lot of skills between both guys, but not necessarily the tallest guys. And he's a guy who also came off the bench a decent chunk of last season, so if Samson sees him more as a six-man, 25-30 minute a game kind of guy, I think that role versatility is there as well. And I think that just scratches the surface, but I think those are the biggest reasons why I'm specifically very excited about adding Damian Dunn to the roster coming back.
Yeah, man, I think you got to be excited because you saw firsthand what he can do. He was had a starring role in Houston's only regular season conference loss this year, had 16 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists, just one turnover in that game. But yeah, spent 4 years at Temple. First year played just one game due to injuries. Second year played just 13. But then finally the last couple of seasons, you know, has been healthy. Second and third team all AAC the last couple of seasons. And I think you have to like the well-roundedness of his offensive game. Takes more twos than threes, but shot a career-high 35% from beyond the arc and made 1.5 triples per game last year. You mentioned he's been top 100 in the country at drawing fouls each of the last three seasons, shot over 80% from the charity stripe each of the last two seasons, creator for others as well. 3 assists per game from a non-point guard is a pretty good number for me. And you mentioned the efficiency numbers, and they were, I think, you know, decent, not amazing this year, but they're all trending in the right direction. You look at basically any statistical category, he's gotten more efficient the last couple of years while also playing progressively more minutes. So, you know, I think in terms of things that you think the staff might want to work with him on, I think you got to start with the turnovers. That's the one area that he's only kind of been so-so at, and he hasn't really seen improvement in his offensive game, at least statistically. You know, his turnover percentage this past year was higher than that of any Cougar guard from this last year's team. The rebounding numbers are respectable, but also kind of a little lower than what we usually see from whoever's kind of the de facto three, maybe. You know, so I have a funny feeling that the importance of rebounding might be stressed to him at some point before we see him suit up, however. So, you know, his defensive habit creation numbers aren't that high also. That's something that I think him and Cryer have in common. So I think if both of them do end up being starters, and I think it's possible, like you said, that Dunn maybe is your 25 minutes off the bench, six man or whatever. But either way, you know, it's two guys. So I think that's something that the staff might want to see a little bit more from them in those areas as well. So, you know, I think in both cases, we're going to talk about this with Cryer as well. It's guys that are you know, not NBA ready, but have NBA aspirations, and they see coming to Kelvin Sampson, and the Kelvin Sampson staff is like, hey, you know, it's tell me what I need to do, and you know, the staff has shown that they can get guys over that hump and get them into the league. So I think it's a good position to be in to be kind of getting those, you know, borderline NBA guys, and I think Dunn and Cryer can both contribute significantly this coming season.
Yeah. As for Cryer, I think the fact that he committed to the Cougars, we've kind of said it a couple times by now, not really a huge surprise. We knew basically from the moment he entered the portal that U of H was going to be a program in play to land his commitment. Besides Baylor, he might be a familiar name from the more distant past. He was a consensus 4-star national top 100 recruit out of Morton Ranch in Katy, and U of H was very much involved in his recruitment, but I remember from back then, it always seemed like Baylor was the favorite to land Cryer, and eventually, in the summer of 2019, he committed to the Bears, would join that program for the past three seasons. And I want to give a quick shout-out here, Dustin, to Baylor, which I know. I'm giving a shout-out to Baylor. Not something I ever expect in this podcast, but so many programs, Dustin, even when people leave amicably, they just, it's a coach, it's a player, they just nuke the profile. And it just makes it that much more. Not that there aren't alternative sources that I could go to find how LJ Cryer did in his college career, but like the team bio is usually a pretty good one-stop shop. It's usually a good combo of the team bio and KenPom, and I think we could do
Dunn's was still up too as of today. So was kudos it? To both Temple and Baylor that I was able to pull up both of their bios today and get some of the info off of there.
Shout out to Temple and Baylor. So wanted to do that real quick at the start here, just because, and again, not that Damian Dunn or LJ Cryer's profile should be taken down, because they gave a number of years to the program in question and aren't leaving under, I think, any not amicable circumstances, but just appreciated that. Started his Baylor career, as you could probably do from the math, on that national championship team. Had a pretty similar role to Jamal Shedd on the Cougars, in that Cryer played a decent number of games, but really wasn't a meaningful rotation guy in the 20 games they played for Baylor's 2021 national championship team, mostly a mop-up and very short spells kind of guy. But in his sophomore season, he took a big step forward with an expanded role, mostly came off the bench, but still averaged 13.5 points a game, shot a really impressive 46.8% from beyond the arc in just over 26 minutes per game, but unfortunately ended up suffering a foot injury and missing the last 15 games of that season, including the Bears' NCAA tournament run. This most recent season, Cryer started all 31 of the games that he played in, ultimately ended his Baylor career with a career-best 30 points on 13 of 22 from the field in their round of 32 loss to Creighton. For the season, his three-point shooting percentage decreased a bit from that absurd number I referenced from his sophomore season, but still shot a very healthy 41.5% on nearly 200 attempts from deep, shot just over 45% from the field, while I think really doing a lot more offensively close to the basket versus his first couple seasons in that Baylor program, where the vast majority of his offense came beyond the arc, was the number three scorer in a Baylor team that just finished the season as the number two offensive efficiency team in all Division I. So I'm not going to say anyone's a like-for-like replacement with Marcus Sasser because of all the really good things Marcus Sasser did, and I think that's also an unfair thing to throw on a incoming player. Oh yeah, just no pressure, just be every bit as good as the guy who was our first consensus All-American since Olajuwon. But in LJ Cryer, if you're not aware, this program is getting a very, very offensively skilled player.
Yeah, I think the big headline is you just added maybe the best three-point shooter in the country. Over six three-point attempts per game this past year, still hit 41.5%, like you mentioned. And even that, like, kind of like you said, drop-off, but you know, a lot of that had to do with kind of a slump at the beginning of the year. From January 14th onward, he was actually back at 46-plus percent from beyond the arc. And for
he
all
hit
the threes,
almost half his threes in Big 12 play. That's absurd. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, and did actually take 46% of his field goal attempts from inside the arc, was a 50% shooter on those as well. All that plus the all he did last year was set a couple of school records. 30 points in an NCAA tournament game against Creighton was a school record. 89.4 free throw, 89.4% free throw shooter, also a Baylor single season school record. So you put, you know, really good shooter from all three levels, makes him one of the more efficient scoring guards in the country, which is why he had basically every school in Division I after him. I forget who it was, but some, you know, national media writer, I think it was, had some, tweeted some graphic afterwards. It's like, school's interested in LJ Cryer. And it was just a giant graphic with every single Division I logo, because that was basically, you know, anyone that thought they had a chance at landing LJ Cryer was pretty much trying to recruit him, but ultimately ends up with the Cougars, with his hometown school, which is obviously really exciting. And yeah, like you said, despite being listed at just 6'1", really hasn't been utilized or wasn't utilized in Waco as a point guard. You know, one of the things that he said during the transfer process is he doesn't want to entirely abandon being a you know, an off guard, because he's such a good shooter. You want to have him in a spot where you're getting him lots of shots and trying to, you know, run off ball action for him, get him some open looks and things like that. But, you know, he wants a chance to play point more than he has up until this point. And, you know, I think feels like a good fit at U of H, actually. Well, he'll be, you know, likely starting alongside Jamal Shedd, but we'll kind of take up that Marcus Sasser mantle, like you said, of being the two guard, but also kind of being the de facto backup point guard who can, you know, the 10 or so minutes a game that that Jamal is on the bench. You'd expect to see LJ out there running the show. So, you know, in terms of things that he needs to work on, I think it's certainly clear that he wants to show, like I said, he wants to show NBA scouts that he can play point, because, you know, NBA teams broadly aren't usually in the market for 6'1 shooting guards at this point in time. But, you know, I think he's also got some things to prove defensively as well. I think Baylor, it kind of sounds like, from what I've seen, their defense suffered at times having Cryer out there alongside a second smaller guard. And the Houston coaching staff, you know, I think is going to have to worry about teams with bigger guards taking advantage of them if they do, in fact, start shedding Cryer, which you figure is going to be the case at this point. But, you know, I think that's also a reason why Cryer makes sense as a fit at U of H. Marcus is maybe an inch taller than him, if that, but, you know, he's not a real big two-guard either, and we saw Houston have much more success with its two-guard defense than Baylor did. Its two-small-guard defense, I should say, a year ago than Baylor did. So, you know, Cryer gave a quote after committing that, you know, the Houston staff didn't tell him everything he wanted to hear, that they challenged him, and I'm sure that the defensive piece was the source of that challenge and challenging him to be better on that side of the ball. So I think we all know that if Coach Sampson isn't happy with your defensive effort, then he's not going to play you no matter who you are. But, you know, I think that gets my point, which I think in both of these guys, you see two players that can really bring something to U of H. And I think, you know, U of H is fortunate to have them. But I think also you see, you know, that it's a mutually beneficial situation, that LJ Cryer brings, you know, some three-point shooting, you know, and some scoring that Houston needed. But, you know, I think Houston's is gonna teach him to play defense in a way that maybe he hadn't before, and get him more NBA ready on that side. And same thing with Dunn, bringing an ability to get to the free throw line that we haven't seen maybe since Dejan Giroux. But Houston also, you know, giving him the chance to you know, knock on wood, I think I can probably say he's gonna play in the NCAA tournament for the first time. I think that's more than, I think we can say Houston's gonna do that next year. You know, and Cryer, you know, was a real backup player on the team that won the national championship, and certainly knows what it's like to play in the Big 12 and can bring that to Houston. But also, you know, the last 2 years, you know, was injured when his team went out in the first weekend, and his team went out in the first weekend again this year. So, you know, coming to a Houston team that's been to the second weekend 4 years in a row at this point, you know, you think Kreider certainly wants a piece of that action, and wants a deep NCAA tournament run in which he's actually a more significant part of that team's rotation. So, very excited to have them both. It was very dramatic. Like I said, there's a reason we're kind of bucking our usual trend and leading with an off-season sport. But you know, when a team that, you know, looks like it's going to be a top 5 or 10 type of team in the country gets two very big pieces of what the roster is going to look like next year, as Houston did, it certainly is noteworthy, and certainly feel you know, a lot better, a lot more settled in kind of in terms of what we're going to see next year, having seen both of these guys commit.
Yeah, I think I'm comfortable saying that between all the returning players and these two portal additions, that I think this program won't be adding any more guards or wing guard hybrids. And I think the remaining question that both of us, and I'd say most of Cougar fandom, has at this point is whether or not the staff will be adding a big man with the departures of Jairus Walker and Reggie Chaney. And other than Lonnie Roberts, not too much right now if everything stays as is, in the way of proven front court experience. And also, as of this moment, with all the projected incoming and returning players, with the two guys just committed, U of H doesn't have a scholarship left to give right at this moment for the coming season. Of course, these things can be fluid, but what I think is even more telling is the lack of activity you've seen with the Cougs being linked to front court players in the portal. You can correct me if I'm wrong here, Dustin, but I've only seen two front court players in the transfer portal who reported any kind of contact or interest with the Cougars in the last few weeks. Caden Shedrick, who just announced the top five that didn't include the Cougars, a UVA transfer big man, and VCU's Jalen Deloche, who announced a top five or six or whatever without U of H a week or two ago.
Yeah, so, I guess Robert Jennings, yeah, a couple weeks ago too, but he also announced the top two or three that involved U of H. And yeah, it has seemed very quiet ever since, you know, especially since the two guards. It is, and even before then, you know, it had been a few days since you'd really heard anything with any of the forwards. So who knows? I'm sure if, I mean, and again, it's a two-pronged question, right? Kind of like you mentioned, you know, is the staff really still feeling like they need to strengthen the front court? And also, you know, if so, then like you said, someone's got to be heading out in the other direction to free up a scholarship spot. So, wouldn't be surprised if this is the 13 scholarship players we see heading into next year, but I think there's the potential to maybe make a one-for-one swap and rebalance the roster a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, I'll very much trust Kelvin Sampson and the staff if they believe they can go into the coming season with this roster as is, and if that's what happens, I would encourage the fan base at large to do the same, but I will admit my surprise here if this is indeed it for offseason roster movement in either direction. One other thing I wanted to point out real quick, It's the curious nature of the eligibility situation for all the guys who you think would be seniors this year. You alluded to some of it, Dustin. Damian Dunn and LJ Kreider both come in with up to two more years left because both guys played during the COVID season, which doesn't count against anyone's eligibility. And Dunn also had an injury redshirt his true freshman season. Wani Roberts also took a redshirt in the 2019-2020 season, played in the COVID season, so he should have two more seasons to play if he wants them. Jamal Shedd and Kreider both started their college careers in the COVID season, so both of them should have two more years to play. And additionally, we didn't see him this past year, but Malik Wilson took a redshirt year and played during the COVID season, so he also should have two more years. And that means right now, as it stands, Dustin, with four-star recruit Mercy Miller committed in the 2024 class, technically if everyone tried to return from the season that is to come to the season after next, U of H would have one fewer scholarship than needed. And I'm sure when we get to 12 months from now, we probably almost certainly will not have a situation where everyone on the roster is dead set on returning. But I'm just curious, out of the older guys on the roster, who ends up taking that extra year and returning for this program's second Big 12 season. It certainly makes for an uncertain future predicting exactly what the roster is going to look like over the next few seasons.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I think we have a pretty good idea, you know, plus or minus one player, what the roster is going to look like for next year. Would not want to have to make too many solid predictions about what the roster is going to look like even 2 years down the line. So we'll certainly see, you know, in terms of this coming season, you know, and the roster bounce, kind of like we were talking about, one of the things that I think is maybe an X factor here is, you know, we saw Terrence Arsenault play some small ball four this year, you know, with one more year of working with Alan Bishop, maybe to get a little bit, you know, bigger and stronger. Maybe they feel more comfortable having him kind of be, you know, where your starting four is, you know, is Wani, and then you got both, you know, maybe like Tugler and Arsenault kind of backing him up at the four. And then if your starting five is Javier Francis, and you got, you know, the other freshman Lott and McFarland backing him up, then maybe you feel like comfortable with that. But I don't know. I don't like advocating too hard to like bring it up forward, because that means by definition you're kicking somebody off, and there's no player on this roster that I go, yeah, no, I'd be happy if he, like, there's no player that could leave, and I would be like, oh man, like I kind of thought he might contribute for us. It's a pretty good roster up and down. It's a pretty good 13-man scholarship group there. But yeah, no, definitely curious to see whether they're just going to play a little bit smaller, maybe get Arsenault some minutes at the four. Maybe they just feel really good about Lott and Tugler, and feel, you know, and or McFarland, and feel, you know, two of those guys are ready to really step in and play significant minutes right away. I don't know. We'll certainly see. And like you mentioned, we say it a lot, but it's been a wise move in recent years to trust Kelvin Sampson and his staff to make the right decisions.
No doubt.
All right, moving right along, there's a sport that we haven't talked about in a few weeks and we do want to get to, because they've actually been doing a pretty impressive job, and that is the Cougar Track and Field program, which is about halfway done, about 1 month into the 2 month long outdoor season. The Cougs just recently hosted the newly rechristened Cameron Burrell Alumni Invitational, honoring the late great U of H sprinter who tragically passed away 2 years ago. Auburn competed at the event, which meant that Cam's father, Leroy Burrell, was there, as was the rest of the Burrell family. So obviously a bittersweet moment for everybody involved, remembering a son and a brother and a friend gone too soon. But making the impossible segue to talking about athletic performances and how the Coug track and field program is doing, you know, after indoor season was kind of a bummer, it's actually been a really encouraging outdoor season thus far. Especially strong performances at the famous Texas Relays the weekend before last. The Cougars actually do have a number of athletes who look like serious contenders to win conference hardware and or be a threat to qualify for nationals and score some points there. And, you know, it's exciting to start with the sprinters, and Sean Maswanganyi really looking like he is, like that Ferrari is fully near top speed, at least ran a 100 meter time of 10.01 seconds at the Texas Relay. That's the best time of anybody in the country thus far, has a 300th edge over Wanya McCoy of Clemson. Sean also currently number 9 in the 200 meters with a time of 20.41 seconds. That's also a mark that he set at the Texas Relays. And on the women's side, Houston has a sprinter who looks like a contender to make it to nationals as well. Cecilia Tamayo Garza, currently number 11 nationally in the 200 meters, number 19 in the 100 meters. Both Tamayo Garza and Maswanganyi are the current AAC leaders in both the 100 and the 200 meter events. So Sam, you know, lots to like about the Cougar Track and Field program and outdoor season, and you know, it's a program that's had a lot of amazing sprinters, and glad to see the Cougs kind of leading strongly on you know, both the men's and the women's teams in the sprinting right now.
Yeah, and Tamayo Garza has been a really fun one to watch. Not that we don't enjoy it when an athlete comes into this program and is just instantly quite good. One Sean Maswanganyi certainly falls into that category. But what we've seen from Tamayo Garza, I think, over the last few seasons is someone really progressed from being a, you know, conference contender, going to definitely do conference podiums and every so often might get mentioned when we talk about the track and field program, to one of the very top line athletes we talk about when we talk about this program. And says something, I picked this up from the write-up about the Texas Relays, where Sean Maswanganyi ran that 10.01 100, that's currently the top time in the country. But it says something about the absurd sprinting history of this program, Dustin, that, and I don't know all the mechanics of what basically wind does to affect your time exactly, but because it was like somewhat wind dated, it's not even a top five time in Cougar track and field history. That's just, you know, some guys named Carl, Leroy, and Cameron over the years have ran a few fast 100-meter dashes. Finished behind only professional Emmanuel Matadi at that event specifically. I'd imagine we're going to see some sub-10-second 100 times before too long in the season, hopefully from Sean, but certainly from Sean or that kind of general group of elite sprinters. But I think he's made it abundantly clear he'll continue being one of the very top names to watch in this event between now and outdoors in a couple months. And that immediately after that blazing fast performance of the 100, he went out there to run in the 200 meter finals and posted what is a current top 10 time in that event as well at the Texas Relays. I want to shout out a couple other athletes as well real quick here, Dustin. Davion Wilson, also a couple weekends ago in Austin, ran his best time of the season, 13.41 seconds. Put himself top five nationally for the season so far, and it's absolutely wild to add that two of the four athletes on the leaderboard currently in front of Wilson also set their times at the Texas Relays, although I guess not that wild considering the level of competition at that meet year in, year out. And Christian Sampi made his outdoor season debut in Austin, posted was still a top 10 mark nationally at 5.51 meters cleared on the men's field side as well.
Yeah, and in terms of national contenders on the women's side, in addition to Tamayo Garza, you've got Destiny Lawrence in the triple jump, Priscilla Adejikun in the hammer throw. Both of them are top 20 nationally, both currently number two in the American, but well within striking distance of qualifying for nationals. And then in terms of, you know, athletes who are real, you know, contenders for conference hardware, you know, you mentioned Devian Wilson in the 110 hurdles, but number two in the American is his teammate DJ Akindele, number 31 in the country, so not terribly far off there as well. Then, you know, the Cougs also have Trey Johnson, currently tied for second in the AAC in the 400 meters. Looks like he'll be in the middle of a highly contested conference event with a bunch of guys in contention there. Sophomore Adam Mason, the current AAC leader in the 800, over a second and a quarter ahead of the next best AAC competitor in that event thus far. Senior Benjamin Okafor has qualified for nationals before, is the current AAC leader in the long jump. Cougar freshman Aaron Davis the second is number two in that event. And the junior trio of Caleb Malboro, Jaden Brome, and Quentin Stringfellow, currently 2, 4, and 5 in the American in the triple jump. That looks like it'll be a close event that all three of those guys should be right in the midst of as well. And then on the women's side, Sydney Townsend in the top 40 nationally in the 400 hurdles, currently a close number two in the American. And in the throw squad, in addition to Adejikun, you've got Nuu Asala-Tuliafano and Daisy Moni, who both put up their best shot put performances of the year at the Camberwell Alumni Invitational. They are the current number one, number two in the American. So excited to see the throw squad continue to be a strength for the Cougs. And, you know, in the women's side, it certainly looks like UCF is going to continue to be the best team in the American this year. But, you know, the men's side is certainly trying to salvage some pride after the not winning the conference indoor title, and, you know, looking like they'll have a decent shot to grab the outdoor title. And, you know, I think I've seen them even ranked in the top 15 or so of the national rankings. So definitely, like we mentioned, plenty of athletes, I think, within contention to not only qualify for nationals, but maybe even score some points once they get there. And I don't think we mentioned also, you know, you kind of know it's going to happen, but to the Cougs, 4x1 relay, no surprise, a national contender. Their best time of 39 seconds flat came a few weeks ago at the Victor Lopez Classic. That's good for number six in the country. The Cougs also the AAC's best mark in the 4x4 relays. The Cougar women currently number two in the conference in both relays. So a lot to like about what's going on, I think, with both Cougar men's and women's track and field right now.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add is that it's going to be really interesting to watch. We talked about the top line athletes at the beginning, but all those athletes that are kind of between 20th and 40th right now on the leaderboard of their respective event, and seeing how many of those athletes, because it'll be a decent amount. I think we've gotten kind of used to seeing this program have athletes really be competing their best here in a month or so at outdoors. But I guess certainly on the men's side, I think on the women's side, not to say it's fait accompli, but UCF on the women's side is really good. UCF is going to be hard to beat. I think it's more about, for, you know, the Cougars, their goal is just to do a good deal better than you did this time last year. Your goal is to make it a lot closer to the Knights in the leaderboard when it's all said and done. Who knows? Maybe you make things interesting and pull an upset there in Tampa at outdoors. But I think it's just about being better than the previous year. But I think with the men, the key there, and the key to, I think, going on a high note after, I think, the last couple championships weren't exactly characteristic of what this team has done in its last two conferences in the last 20-something years, largely under Leroy Burrell and now under Carl Lewis and Will Blackburn. It's not what Sean Maswanyani is going to do. It's not what Davion Wilson is going to do. Those athletes are going to likely win their event and win it pretty comfortably. It's how many other guys are going to join Maswanyani in the points in the 100 meter. It's Christian Sampi. Does Christian Sampi, unlike I think last season, save his best performance for last, or, you know, maybe goes into outdoors and doesn't have his best weekend in a ultimately tight conference loss, which is not me blaming Sampi here, but that was kind of endemic of what happened to the men last time, as that you got a lot of good but not great performances outside of maybe the big few names, and ended up a bit short in the points total, as all said and done. So I think the program's definitely capable of it, but it'll be interesting to watch all those athletes kind of between 20 or so and 40 now in their event leaderboard, and whether we're going to be talking about them as serious contenders to beat NCAA outdoors with the likes of Maswanyani and Wilson and likely Sampi and Tamayo Garza.
All right, so moving right along, we have our patron question of the week, and that is belongs to Sean, who asks, if you're Kellen Sampson, you could clearly go run your own program at this point. Do you go run a new program for a few years to get some experience and time on your own before possibly returning to Houston, or do you stay in Houston, stay with your family and support group, and wait until it is your turn? Seems like it would be a tough personal decision. Sam, what are your thoughts on this?
I think before I give my specific two cents, I think I want to acknowledge at the top that I think you can make a good argument for both. I think you can make a good argument for continuing to learn under Kelvin Sampson, continuing to be a pivotal part of this program's growth, or go somewhere else and experience the specific challenges of being a head coach that no amount of being around and being very close with the current head coach will truly teach you. And I think really it's kind of a matter of personal preference, or I guess in this case, Kellen Sampson's personal preference as the one of one who ultimately gets to make this decision here. But I don't say this to say that I don't think he would get value out of being a head coach somewhere else, but I think how he sees it, and I think you can make a good argument for this, and I will, is that you could still learn a lot by being around Kelvin Sampson every day. And it's clearly a work experience that this staff likes. I tell you, it is so not normal that even for successful programs to have the lack of assistant turnover that U of H has had the last 5-6 years. And it's a good not normal. It's a not normal that I think allows U of H, who already has one of the very, very best head coaches in the country, to be so successful because you have a staff full of guys, I guess in Casey Beard's case, dating back to when he was a non-coaching staff member, but you have these guys who have worked together at least the last 5 or 6 years. So you work with someone long enough, you either grow to hate their guts or you really genuinely enjoy working with them. And I don't sit in meetings every day with Quanis White, Kellen Sampson, Casey Beard, and the rest of the staff and Kelvin, but it seems like these guys really like working together. And I think if we can all acknowledge that Kelvin Sampson is one of the very best in the country at teaching at X's and O's, at managing in a way that's tough, but clearly doesn't burn guys out, clearly breeds intense loyalty from current players and past players, and that you see this program, there's always guys around it, either, you know, recent U of H alums. You see a lot of also OU and Wazoo alums come and visit the program periodically, that all three assistant coaches, I know Kellen's a special circumstance because he's his son, but that all three, or excuse me, two of the three assistant coaches, also including Hollis Price, who is, his title is kind of murky. He is on the bench with them, but I don't know if he has the title of assistant coach, but that you have Hollis Price, Quanis White, and Kellen Sampson, who all played for Kelvin at Oklahoma too, and after that, and still decided to voluntarily, like, hey, I'm going to spend a whole freaking lot of time around Kelvin coaching. I think that speaks to the intense loyalty he breeds, and then I think understanding among those guys that this man is one of the very, very best to ever do it. And I think also you can make a U of H specific argument here too, that Kellen, I think in an ideal world, wants to come into this roster fully familiar with the guys on it. Obviously it's going to be his program. He's going to do it at least somewhat differently than Kelvin, because no two human beings are exactly alike. But I think he would rather come in this roster not being like, oh, I know a handful of guys from recruiting and from when they were underclassmen as coach, but I think he would also rather not come in here not having, you know, not having 3 or 4 years worth of catching up to do. I think he would like to, if he takes over as head coach here, slide directly from the assistant seat to the head coach seat. And seems like he thinks it's going to happen just based on how he's treated the job cycle, a job cycle where, I think as Sean pointed out, he would absolutely be able to land another program's head coaching job that's open if he wanted it. But I think he really does, and I think this is supported by his actions the last few seasons. I'm not saying there's a 0% chance that he's going to eventually lead to another program's head coach, and that I wouldn't support him 100% if Kellen Sampson decides that's the way he wants to go. But I haven't seen any convincing evidence for a good long while that he is seriously pursuing openings, which to me shows that he believes that he is going to be able to eventually at some point slide directly from associate head coach to head coach of this program.
Yeah, I agree with you in the sense that if this coming week some shock news comes out of the blue and Kellen Sampson accepts a job somewhere or something like that, or if the next offseason happens, I'd become a fan of whatever, within reason, with basically whatever school he was coaching next year, or whatever the case would be. But I think I'd be a little surprised if we see him leave, just for a couple of reasons. One is I think he really wants to be here in terms of the well-documented family situation that the Sampsons have got going here. And in terms of kind of like what you said, you'd have a hard time being in better head coaching school than getting to be kind of the lead assistant under Kelvin Sampson. So it's obviously an extremely good situation for him. And kind of like you mentioned, you'd have to imagine that the ultimate goal for him is to become the head coach at the University of Houston. And I think there's a lot to be said for maintaining consistency the entire time and never and not having to inherit a roster of any players that you didn't personally recruit. I think there's something to be said for getting that head coach experience for sure. I think that's fair also, but he also doesn't need that to get the job because it's already kind of written into the contract that he's going to be the head coach. He can get that head coach experience as the head coach at Houston. And I have a hard time imagining what the situation would be that would make sense for all parties for Kellen to like go somewhere for the next 4 or 5 years until his dad decides to retire and then come back. Just because, you have to go to a school where you got to figure the people at that school kind of know what's going on. They know they're kind of renting this coach for a short period. If it's anything other than some, blue blood program that might make him, want to stay and not come back to Houston, then you're hiring him as a rental. And the way that the transfer portal is, that means you're also hiring knowing that if he's got any players good enough to take with him to U of H, that they're going to be gone. And, maybe they just leave because it's a new coach either way. So maybe you're going to blow up your roster in a few years when he goes back to Houston. And then for Kellen's point, if truly your objective is to be the most ready that you can be to be the head coach of the University of Houston in the Big 12, I feel like you'd have to go to if not the Big 12, a really good conference to simulate what that's like in some extent. If he accepts anything other than one of a good job in a major conference, I don't know that's preparing you more to be a head coach in the Big 12 than being an assistant coach in the Big 12 would. And I don't know that a school that would make it worth it for Kellen Sampson would be willing to take the trade-off of hiring the coach who is going to leave to go back and be the head coach at Houston when his father retires. So I have a hard time envisioning the right scenario. I think certainly the possibility is there because he's obviously a tremendously talented recruiter, tremendously talented developer of talent. He's someone that, any athletic director that actually thought that they could bring him in long-term, I'm sure would be salivating at the thought of doing so at a number of schools. There's enough of a pull there. You have to take it seriously, but like I said, for me, it is hard to envision the correct scenario that works for all parties.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Dustin, you ready to talk some bat and ball sports?
Let's talk some bat and ball sports, Sam. I believe you are going to be doing the report on the baseball team. So how are those Cougar baseballers doing, Sam?
You're correct. I have bought Cougar baseball talk here for show and tell tonight, and I'm happy to report that the results continue to be positive around the program. The team traveled up to Wichita for their first conference road series of the current season against Wichita State Shockers, returned to Houston winners of 2 of 3, and looked good doing it against an opponent that we talked about having a good lineup that was coming off a really good midweek win where they drubbed a top 25 Big 12 team in Oklahoma State. And the Cougars got to start last week on a high note with a really wild win over the Rice Owls at Schrader Park in the first of three Silver Glove Series midweek games that are going to be played this season. And I wasn't in Houston for this one in the flesh, so I can't speak to the weather specifically, but the official game box score lists 15-mile-per-hour winds blowing out, which maybe, I guess, shows no big surprise that this one ended up being quite high-scoring for both teams. Cougs actually took an early lead in this one, courtesy of an Anthony Tuilomero solo dinger, a lot of that coming this week, and an Ian McMillan RBI double to follow. Got the Cougars an early 2-0 lead, but Rice would respond with a 4-spot in the third. Wouldn't give the lead back until much, much later in this ball game. And from the third inning through the end of this game, Rice only had one inning where they didn't score at least one run, which is a wild stat considering that I'm talking about this game knowing that the Cougars would end up winning. Top of the sixth, actually, Rice extended their lead all the way out to 11-5 from a Ben Royo 3-run dinger. Was looking kind of grim, but the Cougars immediately responded in the bottom half of the sixth inning. Malachi Lott hit a solo homer, and after a rare scoreless top of the seventh from the Owls, Cougs scored 5 runs to tie it up. In the seventh, Tuilomero hit a second dinger of the game. Lott hit a bases-clearing 3-RBI double to tie the game. The Owls did respond with a solo homer to go back up 12-11 in the eighth, but the Cougs were able to take their first lead since the third with a 2-RBI double from Justin Murray. And the very same Murray, who's now become the Cougars' kind of de facto closer, took the mound for the ninth. And while he did give up the tying run when the Owls started the inning with back-to-back hits, he settled down nicely, ended his inning with back-to-back strikeouts, and set the table for the Cougars to ultimately win this one in the bottom half as Cam Nickens walked it off, his second actually in a 4-day stretch back to the ECU series. Scored Ian McMillan after he had let off the inning with a single, gave the Cougars a 14-13, absolutely wild, but nice to get opening win in the 2023 Silver Glove Series. And the Cougars actually, when they went up to Wichita, got an unexpected day of rest. This was Easter weekend, so you had the usual Thursday through Saturday schedule. The Cougars were actually unable to travel to Wichita in time for the original Thursday opener. Thus, the teams played a doubleheader on Friday and Saturday, and a closing game, excuse me. On Saturday, Cougars got off to a nice start in Game 1. It's got some timely hitting, a second straight strong start on the mound from Josh Eknes as well. He was coming off a pretty awesome showing in the Friday series opener against ECU the weekend before. Ended up pitching into the sixth, Eknes did, struck out 6 Shocker hitters in 5 1/3 innings worked. Cougars got on the board first in this one, which they would do in both wins, thanks to a Wichita error and an Ian McMillan sack fly. Shockers would tie up in the third on a Brock Roden 2-run dinger, but the Cougars would retake the lead at the first opportunity in the top half of the fourth, thanks to back-to-back hits to lead off the inning by Tuilomero and Murray, defensive miscue by the Shockers to get the Cougars' run scored, and Tuilomero would also add to the Cougar lead in the fifth inning with an RBI single. I'm going to talk a lot about Anthony Tuilomero because he hit the ball really freaking good in the past week. Shockers would tie it up in the sixth inning on a 3-run Kyle McDonald home run off the scoreboard off Jose Torrealba, who looked a bit uncharacteristic in relief, but did sell down enough to throw a scoreless seventh and allow the Cougars to take the lead for good in the eighth, which they did via a Brandon Burkle RBI single. Ultimately ended up being the deciding runs, coming from Ian McMillan, who crushed a dinger to left field, scored Burkle, and put the Cougars up 8-5. Shockers did cut into the lead sack fly in the eighth, but Justin Murray came on in relief, limited the damage to that sack fly, and ultimately threw 2 scoreless innings to get his fourth save and a Cougar win. Obviously, Tuilomero, who I've mentioned a lot by now, got a couple critical hits here, but I think it was really critical that you got 3 hits and 5 ribbies from your 8-9 guys in the lineup, Burkle and McMillan. And just having those two guys hitting a decent amount really makes this a hard lineup to deal with, and I think especially in McMillan's case, just something that maybe you weren't seeing as much consistently early in the season, and I think has correlated nicely with the Cougar offense being a little bit more consistently difficult for opposing pitchers. Things didn't go as great in the Friday evening game 2 of the doubleheader. Clark Candiotti was the one pitcher from that weekend rotation that looked impressive but didn't do so impressive on the whole this weekend, but he was quite good, really befuddled the Cougar lineup. 11 Cougar hitters struck out in 6 2/3 innings of scoreless ball from Candiotti, and no Cougar hitter was able to manage more than one hit individually, which I think kind of tells you the story of this one. And it's a little unfortunate because I think Paul Schmitz continues to look really solid in the weekend rotation, and in this game really did a good job pitching around some uncharacteristically poor defense behind him. Ultimately threw 6 1/3 innings, was responsible for four earned runs, but only walked two hitters. Was a game to forget on Friday night, but you still put yourself in a decent position by splitting the day, and I think Saturday's series may have taken any bad taste you have had about the Friday loss out of your mouth, because despite the fact this was a 17-3 run ruling final score from the Cougars, this was actually, if you didn't really follow it along in real time, a pretty close game, a reasonably close game, for the majority of proceedings. The Cougars did get on the board first and ultimately never trailed. Tulo Mero started off the scoring with a 2 RBI double. Justin Murray added one as well to put the Cougars up 3 before the Shockers even got to hit. And I want to shout out another pitcher also. Cade Citelli took the mound to start and had by far his best outing as a Cougar, struck out 8 Shocker hitters in 5+ innings, and I think really most importantly only walked one opposing hitter. And to zoom out for a second, I think it was really cool to see Citelli and Josh Eknis, both guys who came into this program with really promising swing and miss stuff, but not the prettiest numbers in their D1 careers prior, to really see both guys who also kind of struggled out of the gate this year, to see both guys starting to put it together, to see that high level swing and miss stuff without both of them averaging a walk per inning. I mean, that's the lineup obviously played a big part this weekend. You can't take away what the hitters did, but if you don't have those guys putting you in good position, I don't know, maybe we're talking about a different kind of weekend. But Cougars did, to get back to the game a second, extend their lead to 4-0 in the fifth, thanks to Malachi Watt in an RBI single. Shockers did finally get to Citelli for a run in the fifth and did cut the lead to 4-3 in the sixth with help from a Cougar defensive miscue. And following this game in real time, if you had told me in that seventh inning the Cougars would respond for a couple of runs, I'd have been really excited with that, because at that point in the game, the bats had gone kind of quiet since the first inning, and the bats woke up a bit in the seventh inning. The Cougars sent 17 hitters to the plate in that seventh inning, hit 2 home runs, and scored 13 runs, with every single one of those 13 runs coming with 2 outs on the board. Cougars also took advantage of some free base runners, drew 3 walks and 3 hit by pitches. It took 41 minutes, Dustin, from start to finish to play that top half of the seventh inning. Wichita State used 6 different pitchers in an effort to get out of that inning. And it's hard to pick one highlight from a 13-run inning, but I watched the replay too. Justin Murray took some time to admire a ball that he just absolutely crushed onto the busy street that runs parallel to the Shockers outfield fence. Kerry Arboleda also opened his account with his first Cougar career home run to put the Cougs up 17-3 and close the scoring. And I thought this was funny. Owen Woodward, pitching probably his least pressure-filled inning of the entire season, strikes out the side to get the Cougars home, winning 2-3. And I'm not going to overstate what Wichita State is this year, because nobody in the American aside from ECU has been really that consistently good. But they came into the weekend off of a conference series win and decisively beating a good Big 12 team in the midweek and as the number 2 American RPI team. I think you're allowed to be excited about the Cougs taking 2-3 on the road against this opponent.
Yeah, I really like what we saw from the Cougs this past weekend, winning 3 out of 4 overall, getting up above 500 on the year. And really the last couple of weeks, I think the best thing you can say about the Cougars the last couple of weeks is like, man, I really want to restart the season like a couple of weeks ago, you know, because this, obviously I think the RPI numbers are going to continue to hurt Houston a little bit. But this looks like a dangerous team right now. This looks like it's got a lot of players to get excited about. Tulo Mero, the way he's hitting, a lot as good as he's been. Murray, the two-way guy. Schmitz, like you mentioned some of the other starters having some of their best starts of the season. So hopefully we'll continue to see this trend positively going forward, and hopefully continue to be a tough out in the American.
Yeah, it's not all the way there yet. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I was going to move on to softball. If you got more baseball, let's go for it.
I was just going to say real quick, Cougars will be hosting Sam Houston for the Don Sanders Cup at Schrader Park. The Cats are playing pretty good ball right now, but not an unbeatable team. And the Cougars will be hosting USF for the weekend. They're 14-19 overall, the Bulls are, but they have won their first 2 conference series, like the Cougars, including a 2-3 in Orlando against a UCF team that was supposed to be the best non-ECU team in the league this year. So opponent also like the Cougars kind of have been led by their offense this year, but have seen the pitching staff make some improvements in the last couple weekends. So excited to see which one of these teams is a bit less fool's gold, maybe. I always like it when you see a series between two teams that have started conference pretty well, and that's what you'll be getting at Schrader Park this weekend between the Bulls and the Cougars. But that is all the baseball I got, Dustin.
All right, so switching speeds and switching speeds a little bit. I go into Cougar softball, the other bat and ball sport. The good news for Houston after a uninspiring run through non-conference play is that the Cougars have opened AAC competition with a 5-1 record. They're currently second place in the American, trailing only a top 25 Wichita State team. So, I think looking there's some positives to be excited about for sure. I believe we previously mentioned Houston opening conference play with a 3-game road sweep up by Memphis, team that is by a wide margin the worst team in the conference. The Cougs then split a doubleheader against a so-so Stephen F. Austin team at home before this past weekend when they hosted East Carolina. And just like the baseball team did a couple of weekends ago, the Cougs opened and closed the series against ECU with wins, with a loss in between. On Thursday, Houston jumped out to a 4-0 lead off of homers from Bree Cantu, Tariah Coleman, and Emma Robertson, the team's three home run leaders, incidentally. Kenneth Wilkie started out strong with four scoreless innings, would surrender a run apiece in the 5th, 6th, and 7th, but was able to hold on for the 4-3 victory in a 13-strikeout performance for Wilkie, who passed 500 career strikeouts over the weekend. And then I believe it was inclement weather pushed the series finale to a Saturday doubleheader. The Cougs opened the doubleheader with a game that was competitive until ECU exploded for 8 runs in the 5th inning. The Pirates would hold on for a 12-8 victory to even the series, despite Bree Cantu homering for the 2nd straight game. But the Cougs took the rubber match, rallying from deficits of 4-0 and 6-3 in the second half of the doubleheader. From that 6-3 deficit, Houston then scored a run apiece in the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th innings to win this one 7-6. Brooke Lorenzo smashed the game tying homer in the 6th inning, and then Amanda Carton provided the walk-off base hit with the bases loaded in the bottom of the 7th. So Houston happy to take the series win, although I think from here is maybe I feel like that's all the optimistic part. From here, it's gonna be a little bit less optimistic. So I think big picture, taking 2 of 3 at home against a now 1-8 in the American ECU team, where your pitching staff still really struggled for a decent amount of the weekend, is still, it's not bad. You got a series win, but it's not the most encouraging sign imaginable. But it does kind of, bring you to the cold reality of what is facing Houston coming into focus. So yes, 5-1 in the American is good. Even against bad teams like Memphis and ECU, 5-1 is pretty good. But, now you've got top 25 Wichita on the road this weekend. You've got a Tulsa team after that that's at least as good as the ECU squad that just outscored you over 3 games in your own ballpark. And then you've got the Florida schools, who aren't top 25 schools like Wichita, but they're very much looking better than anybody that Houston has faced in conference play over their 5-1 start, for sure. So, kind of like the baseball team, the softball squad is in a good position in the standings. Actually, a game better, 5-1 to baseball's 4-2, despite being around 500 overall, despite being also the owners of an RPI that's probably not going to get you into at-large regional consideration, barring a minor miracle. But, if anything, I think I'm a little bit more pessimistic about the softball program than I am about baseball, just because baseball's already played the toughest team in the conference. Softball very much has that coming up this weekend. Baseball looks like it might be turning a corner from a pitching perspective. Softball, it doesn't really look like they are doing that yet. So despite the 5-1 record in conference play, Cougar softball, a lot to prove. But, hey, they can certainly prove an awful lot if they were to say, take 2 of 3 up in Wichita this weekend, because the Shocker is a very good team, 34-7 overall, 8-1 in conference play. They will have won 5 of 6 against the Florida schools, who the RPI would tell you those are the two best other teams in the American. So it sure looks like the Sockers have already faced and passed their toughest tests in conference play. They're number 24 in the RPI. They've got a trio of pitchers who all see consistent usage in Alex Aguilar, Lauren Howell, and Allison Cooper. None of them have big strikeout numbers, but they've all been really good at keeping opponents in the yard. The Cougs have been driving the ball out of the park more lately, so that's going to be a challenge to keep that going against a strong pitching staff. But then even more what jumps out at you is the offensive side of the ball. They hit a ton of home runs. They've hit 60 to be specific. That is the fifth most of any team in the country. Addison Bernard and Zoe Jones, a dozen homers apiece. So going to be a very, very challenging weekend series, Sam, especially facing this team in Wichita where they are 17-3 overall and on an 8-game winning streak. But, you know, hey, if you're a Cougar softball team, you're looking to prove yourself to get that RPI up there to make a statement of intent in the American Athletic Conference. You know, winning a game or two up in Wichita would go a long way.
Yeah, I think even taking 1-3 and having one of the other losses be competitive is at least going to open my eyes a bit. Just that's how good this Shocker team is, especially that lineup. It is hard to see things going well if anyone other than Kenna Wilkie pitches this coming weekend. And even Wilkie, strong as she's been at times, is going to be challenged by the Shocker hitters. This is one of the very, very best lineups in the country. And I think, I mean, it's good to see from the week previous that the Cougar lineup is doing what you'd expect them to do against one of the not elite teams in the conference scheduled, two good games offensively in the midweekers against SFA. And it's worth noting that ECU is a good deal improved over last year, I think historically for the last few seasons, but it still feels like you're one good or at least decent pitcher away from the past week being a 5-0 week, because during that week, anyone not named Kenna Wilkie that stepped into the circle was absolutely terrible. And it's frustrating to see how good Wilkie can be in games like game one versus SFA, like the series opener against ECU, but how unplayably bad the rest of the pitching staff is. And I feel like I'm repeating things that you and I have both said a fair amount in the current season. Frankly, repeating things when we previewed the team before the season, when we kind of said to ourselves that, yeah, pitchers can come out of nowhere and have good seasons. Hannah Todd last season was good evidence of that, but we didn't see anyone else on the staff other than Kenna Wilkie who looked like a pitcher you would trust regularly. And I think if anything, that group has done a bit worse than you expect. I think my hope was you at least had one that was going to be a high to mid threes ERA pitcher out of that group. And just, I mean, Dustin, I think I did the math right here. The non-Kenna Wilkie pitchers have accounted for a 7.56 ERA this season. And if you have to kind of recalibrate your numbers from baseball to softball, that's a bad number for baseball. That, oh, I don't want to be this harsh, Dustin. That's an atrocious number for softball. And that you only have one reliable pitcher, and that the staff, I think probably for legit reasons, isn't comfortable for throwing her for an absurd percentage of your innings. That's always going to be a cap on this team's ceiling. And that's kind of why I'm in the same place you are, you know, but baseball maybe being a bit more optimistic about it than softball. And it's frustrating because this is a really good lineup. This is the lineup that it's taken us several years since we've seen it. This is a lineup that has lived up to every bit of the preseason hype and then some. Tariah Coleman's having one of the best seasons in Cougar softball history as a hitter, and yet we're talking about a team that pretty much has no chance other than winning the conference tournament of making the postseason. That's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, if you could clone Kenna Wilkie, this might be like a regional team. They're, you know, Kenna Wilkie's a good pitcher. Like you said, the lineup has really, you know, come around and is looking very strong. And I think even if you have two pretty good pitchers, this would be a lineup that could make you a pretty dangerous team. But yeah, when you're giving up more than a run an inning when anybody other than your ace is out there, that is an anchor weighing you down in terms of what you can possibly achieve over the course of the season. And that's kind of a bummer of a way to end it, but I think that is the end of our episode. So we'll go ahead and transition to the outro here and say, as always, that we appreciate all of our Scott and Hoen Podcast Patreon supporters. Would encourage you once again to go to patreon.com/SH Podcast. You can sign up for a mere $5 a month to support the work that Sam and I do, and also get access to all that premium content that we're putting out there on a regular basis. You can also support us by going to homefieldapparel.com and using promo code HOLMAN12 at checkout and getting 15% off of your first purchase. You can get in contact with us. We'd love to hear from you. If you're a podcast listener, shpodcast@gmail.com is our email address. @shpodcast is our Twitter handle. So that's it for us. If you made it all the way to the end, congratulations. You are awesome. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had a kick.
kick the soul in. No cap. No cap. No cap. No cap.